Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Welcome to Connecting Faith. So glad to have you tuned in. I'm Neil Stavem. I always enjoy the opportunity to get together with you and have great conversations, and today will be one of those who want to be listening in and hopefully engaging with us as well. I do want to say before we talk about, you know, how living in today's culture has presented some challenges, the subtitle of the book we're going to reference is called Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. And I think there is, that's sort of the two sides of that pendulum, I think, that
yeah,
got to go from one to the other. But do want to mention that we've just started the first of the month a great new opportunity with Living on the Edge. Chip Ingram has his new book about the real heaven, and he's making a MP3 message series available if you sign up online.
Real easy to do. Go to myfaithradio.com. The first thing you see actually on our main page there right now is the free MP3s you can get. Just click on that. Easy sign up, and it's free.
Yeah, great. Find what heaven is really like. We'll talk about that. What's the old saying? To live above with the saints above, oh, that'll be glory. But to live below with saints we know, that's another story.
All right, so that's not in the Bible.
I don't think so.
This is what the Bible actually says. So check out that. I like that though.
But we are going to talk about living with our friends and neighbors, and you know, maybe you're like this. You feel overwhelmed as you try to live faithfully, your faith in a culture that seems increasingly hostile to your beliefs. You know, maybe it's politics, marriage, sexuality, religious freedom. You know, it's an ever-growing list of contentious issues. And maybe you find yourself saying, you know, it's just harder than ever to hold on to your convictions while treating friends, neighbors, coworkers, and even family members who disagree with you with respect and compassion. So how do we go about doing that? Well, thankfully, Gabe Lyons and David Kinneman have done some more research on that and written a great piece on this that are going to help us. And we do have some copies of Good Faith to give away. We're going to discuss that during the next hour. So stay tuned and join in with us. And you can be a part of the conversation, by the way. Sign up for the books at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Gabe Lyons is founder of Q. It's a learning community that educates and mobilizes Christians to think well and advance good in society. And he's authored a couple of books, including The Next Christians, The Good News About the End of Christian America, and co-author of Unchristian, What a New Generation Really Thinks About Christianity and Why It Matters, with Dave Kinneman. And he and Dave have teamed up again to bring us Good Faith, Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. Gabe was just on with Bill Meyer here just a few days ago, so we're honored that he'll come back and give us a little bit more time. Gabe, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, thanks, Neil. It's so good to get to be with you guys and to have this conversation and keep it going. I've had a good time over the last few weeks really getting into some really serious discussions about where we sit as Christians and kind of a cultural moment that I think is new for all of us, so it should be a fun conversation.
Well, what you get from reading the book is realizing pretty early on that it kind of feels like the playing field isn't level anymore. I don't know if that's maybe accurate, but if that's the case, how do we go about approaching dialogue and our convictions as kind of a minority voice? I mean, I think we all, maybe it wasn't that long ago, we felt like, well, there's a level playing field. That's not really the case anymore, though, is it?
Well, things have definitely shifted, and I don't know if the playing field was ever really level in that it seemed Christians and sort of our voice and the way we view the world and morality and right and wrong and good and evil, like the perspective we brought to the world really had a lot more influence decades ago than it does today. So in some ways, if we were to talk to an atheist, an agnostic, somebody who didn't believe in faith at all, they would say, oh, it's never been a level playing field. You guys had all of the airtime. You were getting all the coverage. You were influencing all of our politics. And so you hear from, you know, quite a different point of view from other Americans who say, hey, finally it's leveling out. We're starting to have a voice. I think what we point out in this book is when you go through a shift like that, you start to realize that as Christians, we're living in a moment now that's just completely uncomfortable for most Christians because they've not had to experience being in a society that didn't have a general respect for their point of view, a general agreement around morality. And so now that the country is pretty divided along these lines, I would say it's probably closer to an even playing field that Christians and those who totally disagree are now seeing this play out in the public square, but quickly Christians are losing influence. And in some ways, we point out in this book, because of the labels now associated with Christian beliefs of being extreme, there's almost a moral authority that those who don't believe feel they now have to try to dismiss Christianity entirely from the public square. And that's where I think you're referring to, Neil. It's just going to start to feel like we don't have the same kind of opportunities to share what we believe as we once did.
You know, this is a well-researched book, as, you know, the writings that you've done in the past have been that way as well. But I'm just curious, could we have seen maybe some of this coming based on research? Are there markers that if you look back, you can see, yeah, this is sort of the outcome we could expect from this?
Well, I mean, yes, you could look far, far back to, you know, the 1960s, it's referenced a lot, but you look at sort of the moment of the sexual revolution and sort of self-empowerment and just the idea that as individuals we should have complete freedom to do whatever we want and not live under any kind of constraints, be they moral or just otherwise. And so you do have the long effect. One of the chapters in this book is called Life After the Revolution, and it's really trying to define all kinds of unintended consequences that have now played out from a view of the person and ourself being the most important thing, our pleasure, our desires, our choices. When we put that at the center, there's all kinds of destruction that comes around that. And so we talk about everything from how we think about objectifying women and pornography and sexuality to how we think about life and euthanasia and end-of-life care and abortion and adoption. So there's all kinds of things, I think, long-term. I would say more short-term, Neil, even 9 years ago when David and I did the book Unchristian and really laid out how 16 to 29-year-olds were feeling about Christians. You know, some of the things that came back from that was 9 out of 10 believed Christians were judgmental. You know, 85% that were hypocritical, or 3 out of 4 said, hey, Christians are right-wingers, they're too political. You could even see in the research 9 years ago those views of these 16 to 29-year-olds, now that they're 25 to 38 years old, have just grown harder and more cemented. They haven't shifted in the positive direction. As many researchers would suggest, you know, they say, hey, when young people get older, they always grow more conservative, they start to have kids, they start to think about faith again. What we're finding with this generation that we're measuring or measured 9 years ago is many of them, you know, over half of them would not even be married yet. But those who even are having families, they're growing increasingly more confident that they don't want to be subjected to these Christian ideas that feel like are outdated or have in some ways held back our culture and our society from experiencing all that life has to offer. And so I think we could have seen this coming, although it's a unique moment when you see that happening in research where people are getting older and less conservative than they are growing more conservative. So just to put a period on this, Neil, you know, 1 out of 3 18 to 22-year-olds no longer subscribe to any religion. And so they don't believe that faith affiliation is important. They don't think religion is important. You know, and 42% of Americans believe that people of faith are part of the problem with the world. And so that's the dynamic you're feeling right now, is that if you're a person of faith, you go to church, you think Christianity matters, you think the Bible is true, you now are part of the problem to almost half of your neighbors. And so that's what we're starting to deal with.
And I think it's maybe hard to think that, you know, this faith, which is so dear to us and seems so, well, and truly is vital and eternally significant, would be considered irrelevant by some of that. You know, have we just... we've not presented it well, and so it's not considered to be meaningful.
Well, I think we can take on some responsibility for maybe being lazy in how we've thought about our faith and its impact on public life. I think we got very comfortable in an American culture that just kind of assumed a lot of the principles that Christians believed and carried them out in different ways without us having to be very active. And I think the church has gotten complacent. So I think we've got a lot going on that contributes to the irrelevance. And I think one of the arguments David and I make, if you can follow this line of argument, but that Christianity has become so relevant that it's actually now irrelevant. And what I mean by that is so many of the things we enjoy as Americans, you know, freedom of speech, free, you know, the public square, the free exercise of religion, the fact that if you don't believe what the, you know, there's no state religion, you know, the fact that individuals should have a freedom of conscience, the idea of human rights, the idea that education should actually be something that every person deserves as a human being, the fact that we should provide medical care to people who are suffering at the end of their life. These are Christian ideas that have been widely adopted now, and they're just part of our society. And so you find with new generations, they don't know that. That's not being taught. They don't understand that part of what Western civilization was built on were Christian ideas. Not entirely, but in a huge way has influenced it. And so, you know, even think about college education. Well, these are birthed out of Christian ideas. And so in that sense, everybody wants the advantages of what Christianity has brought to our world, but they don't want to understand what you have to give up and what kind of constraints you have to put around yourself to actually benefit from that and to see it lead to flourishing. And so that's the great irony of the moment, is Christianity has become so relevant in American life that it's now garnered the label irrelevant.
And of course, the other side is extreme, and we'll talk about that in a moment with Gabe Lyons. We're talking Good Faith. It's the title of his new book. He and David Kinnaman, who is the leader of Barna Research, and Gabe Lyons is the founder of Q. It's a learning community that educates and mobilizes Christians to think well and advance good in society. And together, David and Gabe have written Good Faith, Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. So we'll talk about that other side, and define what does tolerance mean today, and what are some of the questions that we need to address, and how can we go about living out our faith day by day. Love to have you join the conversation. We've got some copies of Gabe's book to give away, Good Faith, and we'll do a draw at the end of the hour, and actually we have some copies of The Next Christian as well, which is one of his previous books, The Good News About the End of Christian America, How a New Generation is Restoring the Faith. We'll give those both away here today. You can sign up for that at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. If you have a question today about, you know, what does it mean to be a neighbor? How do we live out a faith in our public life? Love to have you join the conversation. Give us a call, 877-933-2484. More with Gabe Lyons in just a moment. To our core convictions, but how do we communicate those? How do we, as Christians, talk with people that we care about and love about the most toxic issues of our day? That's what we're addressing today in our conversation with Gabe Lyons. Gabe is founder of Q. It's a learning community that educates and mobilizes Christians to think well and advance good in society. They've got one of their, I think, major conferences coming up here in a few weeks. We'll find out a little bit more about that. Before that, Gabe co-founded Catalyst, a national gathering of young leaders. He's written some important works, including The Next Christians, The Good News About the End of Christian America. And some 9 years ago, he and Dave Kinnaman co-authored Unchristian, What a New Generation Really Thinks About Christianity and Why It Matters. And the new one we're referencing called Good Faith, Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. And we want to talk about that extreme side of it. And maybe, Gabe, just to give us some sense of how we have gotten this extremist label, and maybe then let's talk about what tolerance means today.
Yeah, well, extreme is one of those labels today you can almost use to write people off entirely from the conversation. It's a word we didn't hear much, but in the last couple of years, you've heard it a lot around ISIS and what's happening in the Middle East. You know, violent extremist and violent extremism tended to be the terms that were used together. We've started to see, though, in the last year, a separation of those terms to where now people can and are labeling views as extremist or extreme views as a way to marginalize those views from society. And so Christians are no different. In fact, in this book, we have an entire chapter and a chart that's just dedicated to laying out 20 different ways in which Americans, types of behaviors that they view that Christians do as extreme. I'll give you a couple of them. You know, 60% of Americans believe if you try to convert somebody to your faith, then that's an extremist act. 52% believe if you believe same-sex relationships are immoral, that that's extreme. 52% also believe if you pray for a stranger, that's an extreme act. You know, a lesser percentage, but still high. People believe that if you're reading your Bible in public, that's an extreme act. You know, but even this, you know, 42% of Americans believe if you were to quit a good-paying job to go pursue a life of missions, that that's extreme. And I think, you know, this is where it gets interesting with this word is, of course, as Christians, we're devoted. So you could almost replace the word extreme with devoted followers of Jesus to say, hey, if I'm going to leave my good-paying job to pursue missions, I'm making a devoted act. Like, I live my life by something other than just the social norms of our society. And I think that's the bigger point here is that Americans are starting to get a little more afraid and a little more sensitive to anybody or anything that says, hey, there's some higher authority than just the government and just your opinion or your feelings or how what is going to offend you. There is actually something I live by, and I've committed my life to live by it. That's scary to a lot of people because they don't live their life that way. They see that as a threat. They see that as like not playing on the same ground. And so once labeled extreme, there's a real sense that let's just try to remove your views from society. You know, David tells a story of a friend in Australia that just adopted recently a girl from India. And this just gives us a sense of how secular governments think about this today. And they basically required this couple who are a Christian family, their Christian faith is what motivated them to adopt this child from India. But the government's enforcing on them the responsibility to take that child to a Hindu temple in order to make sure that child's getting this cultural training and spirituality that comes from India. And that's because they want to mitigate against what they think is an extreme, you know, faith of Christianity that this couple would have. And just think about how ironic that is, that a couple's motivated by their faith to adopt, to do good in the world, and yet the government sees that as maybe an extreme act that's worthy of sort of stepping into it. And that's not happening in America right now. I'm not trying to create false fear about that. But the point is, this is sort of the divide that's happening. Once you're labeled extreme, efforts have to be taken to quiet you, to muzzle you, to kind of dismiss you and marginalize. And the research shows, you know, 60% of Americans are feeling marginalized. They're feeling Christians, American Christians feel, you know, they use those kinds of words that they're misunderstood. Almost half believe that. You know, 38% of millennials. So think about the late teens and 20-somethings, early 30s. They're saying, 38% say, I'm afraid to speak up. You know, Neil, they're afraid to share their conviction because they know that there's some consequence to speaking up in this kind of a culture. And so that's kind of where this extreme idea comes from.
I think it was maybe you gave the example of just, you know, a block party, a church-sponsored block party, and you got into the conversation with someone and you know, they were – or maybe I guess it was a conference in London, and he said, you know, we're spending too much money. And you couldn't really – there was no breakthrough for real understanding. There was really nothing you could say that would kind of get past those prejudices, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, I think there's just this, you know, 46% of Americans believe religion's part of the problem. I mentioned earlier, 42% believe people of faith are part of the problem. This anti-religion idea is so dominating the culture right now that when you say anything about your faith being part of what motivates you, it creates a problem. And I was sharing the story in New York of my neighbor who didn't know who I was, that I led a Christian organization, and he commented at this block party that the church on the street had shut down the whole street to do. He goes, this is the one good thing Christians do every year, you know, because his little daughter was out playing and enjoying herself and having fun. But his view is just so anti that the church doesn't do anything good. So, of course, I had to say to him, well, that's actually something that I talk and write and work on quite a bit. And he goes, oh, you're one of those Christians. And that led into just a great friendship with him of really overcoming that perception because he got to know me. We got to spend time dialoguing about what faith meant to my life, but how I didn't hold that over him, that just because he wasn't a person of faith, just because he was atheist, didn't mean it. I had any less feelings of kindness and love and care for him and his family. And so today, to this date, still we are friends that see one another as often as we can. And so there's a relationship there. I don't know what God will do through that relationship, but that's part of how we overcome that perception is people get to know you. That's harder to do today. It takes us stepping out, having some boldness, but also leading with love, not just with sort of judgment as we engage people who disagree.
You talk about some four areas that represent some great questions that we should address. And one of those is, you know, how can we be neighborly? So talk more about what does that leading with love look like when we want to be neighborly?
Well, I think being good neighbors is like basic, right? We all, I mean, most people who aren't even Christians understand that the Bible talks about the golden rule, you know, and to love thy neighbor as thyself. I think in a culture like we have today, one of the things I point out in this book is the idea of hospitality is going to make a comeback. You know, for Christians, if you're one of those people who's going, hey, just give me the solution, tell me the answer, what's the bottom line, what am I supposed to do to be a part of the solution here? The one thing I would leave you with is become a very hospitable person to your community, to your neighbors, to your friends. Invite people into your home. Cook a meal for them. Engage in real dynamic conversation with them. Build relationships. If you do that, you've probably done more than a church is ever going to do to reach them. Because it's in the substance of that relationship and that foundation that you're going to find over time, there'll be moments where they're having a crisis in their life. And the thing we're finding about evangelism today is that the times people are most open to hearing about faith or appreciating maybe your journey, your perspective, your story, is when they're going through some crisis of their own. It might be a divorce. It could be the loss of life of a family member. It could just be they lost their job or they just had a really tough day, but some crisis is happening in their life. And because you already have established trusted friendship with them that was not contingent on them converting to your faith, then you have positioned yourself better than anybody to be able to speak into their life, to speak truth into their life, to offer them good news. And so that would be the one bottom line I would leave you with is let's be more hospitable people. I learned that on a trip to Amsterdam where I got to spend time with the Dutch people who have been living under these kinds of secular circumstances for many, many more years than we are in America. And what they have found is that beyond a church service, that the way they are finding people come to Christ is just through hospitality. And I think that's something that's easy for us to do. It's not that difficult, but it requires us to make a little bit of effort and develop relationships.
Well, and you also say that we need to do this in community, too. I mean, that's another step that we sometimes want to just go on our own, right?
Yeah, you can't do this stuff alone. I did write in the book, The Next Christians, you know, that being individuals about this doesn't really help much. If you're provoked to kind of engage in this cultural moment and some of the dark areas of our culture, let's be honest, there's some areas that are scary, that are dangerous, that, you know, Satan sort of has his foothold in, and you're stepping into those things. You have to do that in community. You can't do it alone. You have to have and community could be as much as just one other person that's with you, or it could be a few of you, or it could be an entire church. But you want to know that there's a group of you who are on the same page, praying together, thinking together, being able to ask questions to one another. You know, I call it a high feedback loop where people are honest with you. They're not just telling you what you want to hear or what they think you should hear. They're actually feel very comfortable telling you the honest truth about how to do this well. And they're willing to call you out in your own hypocrisy so that you're ensuring that you're not doing more harm than good to try to engage with people outside of, you know, your own typical circles.
We're going to hear more from Gabe Lyons as we talk about this great new work called Good Faith, Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. It's new from David Kinnaman and Gabe Lyons. Gabe's founder of Q. He is author of several books, including The Next Christian, The Good News About the End of Christian America, and we've got some copies of both books to give away. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. Love to have you sign up for that drawing and join the conversation. 877-933-2484. The hour and talking good faith today, being a Christian when society thinks you're irrelevant and extreme. And a lot of it has to do with leading with love. We're learning about that from Gabe Lyons. Gabe is founder of Q Ideas. He's author of The Next Christians, The Good News About the End of Christian America. We got a copy of that to give away, as well as the new book, Good Faith, that he's co-written with David Kinnaman. About 9 years ago, they wrote a landmark book called Unchristian: What a New Generation Really Thinks About Christianity and Why It Matters. And we're discovering that, you know, what that generation thought then is sort of living out today. And so we're sometimes confused about how we talk with the people that we love and know about the difficult issues of our day. And I heard John Stonestreet this weekend on Breakpoint this week saying, you know, we think religious freedom is a good thing, but others see it as a license to discriminate. And David, maybe just before we go on, say a bit more about kind of the idea of tolerance today that, you know, that still, I think, kind of catches us off guard.
Yeah, I mean, tolerance is one of those words celebrated by the youngest generations as the most important virtue, really, of our society. And yet, the great irony of that is how intolerant most people are who hold to certain liberal points of view of those who have these conservative points of view. You know, we 47% of Americans right now don't believe there's a moral right and wrong. They just believe we get to kind of make that up, what we think's right or wrong, whereas 53% do believe there's absolute right and wrong. And so you can see how in our culture there's this conflict. And so usually what's happening in today's terms is those who don't think there's a moral right and wrong, if they hear you say that there is some objective truth, there is something right and wrong, whether it relates to sexuality or how we get along with one another or how we ought to treat other people or so on and so forth, you could be labeled as having an intolerant idea, which is kind of a joke. So we talk about in this book, you know, the idea of true tolerance and fake tolerance. And I referenced the story that stood out to me because Bill Clinton, you know, obviously a president, everybody's aware of like his life and the good things he's done, the bad things he's done. And I think one of the things he says is, look, we've worked through racism as a community. He says we've worked through the LGBT topics. And again, he's coming from more of a liberal point of view on that. But he goes, we have one remaining bigotry in our country, that we can't be in the room with somebody of which we disagree. We can't share a room with them because of how much that amps up the way we engage with one another. And so that's kind of a new phenomenon in this last decade we're starting to experience, and social media certainly isn't helping. It's contributing to that. You know, 55% of Americans believe social media, no, 60% don't believe it makes us more social. You know, I think we could agree with that, but we're living in a time where, you know, we as Christians have to practice true tolerance, which is to respect other people, not only put up with them, which I think some definition of tolerance, they would say, is just let's just put up with people. But no, as Christians, we got to see the image of God in every person, even those we disagree with, and respect that. But we're dealing in a moment where our views many times are being labeled as bigoted or extreme. And so that's going to be a tension to work through.
You, I think, suggest a couple of words, assimilation and accommodation. Maybe just show the distinctive there.
Well, I actually think one is right and one is wrong. So assimilation is not what we should do as Christians. And that word simply means, right, we just become like the culture. That the way that you work through the moment we're living in right now is to just look like the culture, try to be relevant to it, try to assimilate and just kind of live within it. And yet I think a better word to define how we're to live as Christians is that we're to accommodate other views, and other views have to accommodate our point of view. But what that means is it's less of a melting pot idea, which some would use to describe American life is, hey, we all come to America and we kind of melt in together and we just become one. That might be true as citizens and that we function as one as a nation, but it's certainly not true in how our views ought to be represented. And so we don't want to fall under just groupthink where everybody thinks the same. And we would describe it more like a potluck, you know, not a melting pot, but a potluck where every person kind of brings their best dish to the table and you end up with a great meal because there's a lot of diversity, there's a lot of different points of view, and you kind of let the ideas win out for themselves. You don't just shut out ideas because you're threatened by them or you don't like them. And so that's more of a vision, I think, for the future. And Christians, we need to get good at this new skill. We can't just shut out people we disagree with either. We have to learn how we're going to accommodate people who have no faith or maybe have a faith that's different than ours. How are we going to share in a public life together as citizens? That's going to be a new skill, I think, that's important and critical that we learn.
I think I like how you describe it as a soft edge but a firm center. I mean, to kind of give us an idea of how we make space for people that we don't agree with.
Yeah, we got that idea from Barry Corey. He's a good friend of ours. He's the president of Biola University, and he talks about this this concept and really has created that university based around that posture. And it's really a posture that says we're going to, as Christians, what we believe matters. And in an age where people are not sure what they believe anymore, they're not sure if they can trust the Bible. I mean, I'm talking about Christians and the research showing like how much the authority of Scripture is really under attack in a lot of people's lives to appreciate it or to say, I'm going to live my life by this. I think what we're finding is that the Christian has to know what they believe. They have to have this firm center theologically to know what God's design is for human beings, for the world to flourish. And when you have that firm center, it gives you a lot of freedom to have soft edges. You know, you can engage with people who disagree with you. You can hang out with people who have opposing views. You can enjoy God's good creation and just show up and be a part of it. You don't have to wall yourself off from those who you disagree with. Your convictions and your conscience is so strong, you're able to actually engage more with people you disagree with because you're not concerned about wavering. You're not concerned about your ideas sort of being shaped to and fro. As Paul warns us about in Scripture, you're mature in your thinking, and so that grounding actually allows you to operate in the world, I think, the way God needs us to and wants us to, where we're able to engage in very difficult conversations. And you know, let's face it, in the days ahead, we need to be prepared for more difficult conversations with our children, with our friends, our colleagues at work. That's where this is going, and so this book, Good Faith, is really designed to help any Christian start to practice that and to really understand how to be prepared for some of those conversations and understand it's not just about memorizing all the answers. It's about a posture that you take in these conversations that actually allows people to listen to you and to hear you versus just kind of write you off.
Well, of course, you've been for many years focusing on asking the right questions, right? That's been what kind of Q has been all about. But you say we should engage culture by asking the right questions. I think there's three or four that you talk about. Let's talk about how we can ask those questions and why they're important.
Yeah, I think this is just a simple way for us as Christians to think about how to engage culture well is to ask these four questions we lay out in this book, and we call them the right questions. Because many times, you know, we Christians were kind of known for answering questions people weren't even asking, you know, and we start to provide answers and they weren't even asking that question. Well, what are the questions we should ask? And Q, our organization, Q, stands for questions. We do events around the country, around the world, that are designed to help Christians really be informed by really looking at this series of questions and saying, how do we apply this thinking to our life? The first question we say is to ask, you know, what is wrong? I think that's one of the simplest ones. Christians have been pretty good at that one. But our job when we ask the question, you know, what is wrong in the world, is as Christians we're to stop and confront it. We have to stand up. We do have to stand up for what we believe and stop and confront evil in the world. That's easily applied to things like abortion and where we just see absolute violence and degradation happening. I would even say in this refugee discussion, you know, it's been one of those moments politically over the last 6 months to where, you know, some Christians have been shy to stand up and confront things that are wrong, where we've seen, you know, push against Muslims and saying we need to ban Muslims from our country, from one of our presidential candidates. You know, things like that are things Christians must stand up and confront and say, that's wrong. That's not who we as Christians believe we are to be. And even if that's controversial, I believe we have to do that. That's where our credibility comes from, is even when it's uncomfortable, we confront things that are wrong. But the opposite of that is to say, hey, what is good in our culture? You know, what is right? What are the things that we need to be celebrating and cultivating? And for a long time, Christians haven't been as good as that. You know, we're kind of easy to point out the bad things and condemn them, but we're not always the best at pointing out good things, and especially if they weren't labeled Christian. Now, that could be music, it could be film, it could be classical music and art and so many wonderful things, science and scholarship. Like, we need to celebrate all kinds of good things happening in our world and cultivate that more. But the third question is to ask, what is confused? So what's confused? You know, so you know what's wrong, what is right, but what's confused? Because the Christian has to step in and clarify, bring clarity to confusing and distorted things. You know, there's a lot of things distorted in our world. You know, that's what the enemy does. He doesn't have the power to create. He only has the power to distort what God's created as good. And so we as Christians, again, have to be so grounded in his word. We can seek that clarity and compel people forward. I think one of those issues today is sexuality, where there's a lot of confusion, gender identity. Those are the real conversations people are having today. So how do we help bring clarity to something very confused for people? And then finally, what is missing? So in a culture that of Christians, who part of our role is to imagine the world as it's going to be when it's renewed and restored, when all things are made new, we have to be able to create new things and catalyze that within our communities. And so sometimes this is the hardest question for Christians to ask, but it should be the easiest, because we have so infused our imagination with the things of God, with things that are beautiful and pure and true and good and right, that we actually have something to offer to our communities, and we go create new organizations and new books and new projects and new radio shows, you know, that help bring truth to the front. And when we do that, we're actually participating in asking a question and in some ways solving some of the problems that we could easily just sit back and condemn or critique. But then we actually take this active step to be a part of how God might want to see us participate in what he's trying to do to renew.
Asking the right questions is what Q is all about. In fact, your next big conference, big event is coming up in a couple weeks just in Denver. Say more about that.
Oh, yeah, Neil. I mean, once a year, it's just the most fun. It's like a party around, like, great ideas and great people. You know, we'll have 1,400 leaders coming in from all over the country. About 10% will come from global cities around the world who are Christians, who really care about how do we be informed on the current issues. And as we look at the next 12 months, what we do as a team at Q is we really assess where's the world going, best we can tell, what are the questions they're asking. And so we're going to talk about everything in Denver, Colorado, from understanding topics like gender dysphoria, transgender, how should we think about that, to racism. In fact, you can't be in Denver or Colorado and not talk about marijuana, so we're going to talk about that. We're talking about our prison system. We're talking about end-of-life care and euthanasia and what does it mean for Christians to get their head around. What does it mean to help people who have 6 months to live actually live out what God's called them to not take charge necessarily of their own plan for their life, but to say, I'm going to trust God with it. And so what we do at Q is you hear counter points of view, though. You're not just told what to think. You actually hear points of view you're going to disagree with. And in community there, you're asked to, like, discuss, talk about it, talk about what you're learning, what you're getting exposed to here, and actually practice some of these difficult conversations we're talking about. So I'd invite any of your listeners, I mean, if you're looking for a place to go deep into this and alongside people who would care about it, April 21st to 23rd, you can learn more at qideas.org/Denver. So it's just the letter Q, ideas.org/Denver. We do a multitude of experiences, Neil, throughout the city. So that first night, there's a private concert, film screenings, farm-to-table dinners. There's an entrepreneur pitch night where people can see how Christians are leading in the for-profit space and the nonprofit space, creating new businesses, and vote on a winner for that night. And we do learning communities that allow people to get out and go fly fishing or, you know, things like snow skiing, snowboarding. I mean, all the way in late April in Denver, you can still do those kinds of things. And so people can go do those kind of recreational activities, or they can take a deep dive and say, I'm going to spend 3 hours learning more about homosexuality and how the church should respond, or thinking about the refugee crisis and how I can respond to what's happening in my community. So there's really something for everybody there, and I would love for anybody listening who kind of feels their heart stirring with what we're talking about today, think about coming out and joining us and just being a part of it with us. We still have about 200 seats available in a really beautiful downtown venue called the Paramount Theater. We'd love for you to join us.
Qideas.org and /Denver to find out more about that event coming up here in a couple weeks. Gabe Lyons is author of Unchristian and The Next Christians. He is founder of Q. It's a learning community that educates and mobilizes Christians to think well and advance good in society. And he's co-author of the new book, Good Faith, Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. And we're going to talk a little about how do we avoid giving theological answers to political questions, and how do we know the difference? And maybe there's some things we could have could learn from other cultures or groups who have been marginalized and misunderstood throughout history. We'll get to that and more coming up in a moment. By the way, we do have some copies of Gabe's book to give away. Love to have you sign up for that. We do a drawing. Got 3 copies of this great new resource to give away. 877-933-2484 is the phone number. 877-93-FAITH. And you can join us with a comment or question as well. And we'll be back in just a moment. 48 past the hour. Talking with Gabe Lyons today from Q Ideas. Gabe's been speaking on cultural issues where faith intersects with public life for many years and written some great works on that. We've got some copies of his book to give away, The Next Christians, The Good News About the End of Christian America, and also the new book we're referencing today, Good Faith. It's being a Christian when society thinks you're irrelevant and extreme. And it's got some great research in it and some practical, helpful ideas. And one of the things that you address, Gabe, is the fact that we sometimes give theological answers to political questions. So how do we know the difference, and how should we change that?
Well, it's kind of complex to describe. We try to work through this in the chapter, that the way in which we ought to approach a lot of the cultural issues is to just recognize that and sometimes what people are asking us might be a political question about something. And I use the reference of gay marriage, like, do you support gay marriage politically, you know, in our country? And oftentimes we give a theological answer where we say, well, the Bible, you know, tells us that marriage is to be between a man and a woman, and sex should happen inside of a marriage. And so while we're stating what we believe to be theologically true, oftentimes we're kind of dismissing the bigger question they're asking us about political policy or about American politics and what the law should state and how do we protect and not discriminate against people, and really complex questions, and that we need to be careful as Christians to understand our theology does define how we're going to believe about this, because our theology actually tells us here's what we believe God's design is, here's how we ought to live, and this is in every category. But sometimes politics is an imperfect process of setting policy that's never going to be perfect. That's just part of what a government does to try to interact and engage and protect its citizens. And so good Christians are going to disagree on some political policies. I think we know that by now. Like, there's different policies on poverty. Like, how do you best help somebody move out of poverty? Well, good Christians will disagree on what the best policy prescription is for that. But it doesn't mean that theologically they don't agree that we as a church ought to be caring for the poor. And so what we suggest in this book is, as we go through so many new kinds of conversations, and it's going to be everything from ethics and bioethics and all of that to talking about abortion and so many other huge issues Christians have contended with over the last several decades, that we have to know what we believe. We also have to understand that Christians are going to disagree on some of these more minor topics that that maybe kind of don't rise to the level of being completely clear how to deal with this in Scripture. Now, I'm not suggesting, because I know I just mentioned, I don't want to be confusing, that abortion is one of those that can be even discussed. I mean, that is absolutely something that's wrong. We should all politically engage in making sure we do what we can to see abortion cease in our country. But even in that, you're going to have Christians disagree on how to do it. What's the best policy prescription for that? And so what we suggest here is, you know, in using some of our actual examples, we talk about the bakers baking cakes, because like the LGBT community and religious freedom, that current debate happening in our country. In fact, today the Mississippi governor, you know, signed another religious freedom law. It just keeps coming up every week. That does that mean we're discriminating? And what we say in the book is, look, there are some bakers who are Christian who say the most Christian thing I can do for my gay neighbor is actually bake the cake for their wedding. And so as a mission and ministry, that's what we're going to do. And at the same point, another Christian would say, I can't do that. I can't participate in this kind of expressive activity. It goes against my conscience. It goes against my convictions. And which one of those Christians is right? Well, some of your listeners might go, oh, obviously A person is right or B person is right. But the point is, we need to allow some freedom here for God to convict us and work in our own lives and hearts to help us to know how to live this out in the public square. That's changing dramatically, but that doesn't give us a license to change theology or to say what God's word says about these things isn't true. And so that chapter is one of those that's pretty complex, Neil, to describe quickly, but we really try to work through theology, understanding the lens of ministry, the lens of politics, and the lens of the public square, and how there's so many dynamics at play in each one of those, but theology and conviction is where we have to rest the core and foundation of what we believe.
It does drive back to the point, though, we need to have a robust biblical engagement, right? I mean, if we're really going to be able to be, you know, Daniels in this culture that we live in, I mean, we need to have a good understanding of what God's word says.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. And I think it'd be good to, as we kind of get to the end of the hour, to just remind people that this can kind of be overwhelming. You know, when you hear me even sharing some of these statistics, or it could be discouraging, and you just say, man, things are changing so much, I'm not even sure I should open my mouth anymore or know how to engage. Well, what I want to encourage you with is Daniel, as you just mentioned, Neil. He's one of these wonderful examples of somebody who lived through a time where, you know, in his day, he was the extreme one. He was the one that was out of step with the broader culture, and yet God uses him to actually lead the kingdom he lived within. But it wasn't without him having to take on this name, Belteshazzar, right? Or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who took on these names that were Babylonian names. They had to live amongst that kingdom and operate within it, and yet they had practices in their life, whether it was what they were eating in the early stories of Daniel, to whether it was prayer and how much that was shaping the way they were daily. Daniel lived his life with opening his windows and praying three times a day. You know, you start to see that these countercultural practices are what gave them hope. It wasn't just what they could see with their eyes, it was that hope. And then trusting God to work supernaturally. And in the life of Daniel, we see at least three different moments where it's the supernatural activity of God in the midst of that kingdom that actually starts to shift the hearts of the king and shift the hearts of the people. And so what I don't want to do is for you to leave this hour of conversation and think, hey, we need some new strategy. We got to come up with a new way to try to be more relevant or hip as a church to reach people. No, not at all. Actually, what we need to do is get back to the basics of being on our knees before God in prayer, lamenting and repenting for where we've contributed to any of this, but also asking God to open these doors, to lead the way, to do what we know he in his heart wants to do. And at the same point, be in the Word and understand truth from error and understand that in this time, in this moment in history, there will be a lot of error. There will be bad teaching and false teaching and deceit and cunning and craftiness and things that the enemy's always tried to do to distort truth. And the only way you can have your guard up for that is to make sure you're doubling down on what it is that you believe, you're getting in the Word of God, you're around teaching and equipping and exhortation and discipleship and rebuke and reproof that's actually shaping you into the person God wants you to be. And when all that's going on, I think it can give us hope that God still does amazing things and that we should be expectant for what he's going to do, even in a culture where it feels like, man, things have changed quite a bit.
The good news is that the Bible really is full of those examples, even church history as well, right? I mean, we can look back and see other times when the believers have been misunderstood, yet God still went before them.
That's right. I mean, we know throughout history. I mean, I'm telling you the story of Daniel, but we can even look in recent American history, I think, and get great encouragement from even the African-American community. I mean, think about this community who's lived under oppression in the American life for so many centuries and yet had joy. I mean, you look at their churches and just the way that they lived with joy in the midst of circumstances where they were treated as awful minorities, where they didn't have the same rights and ability to operate in our culture. They're a minority group for sure, and yet they had joy and strength. That's one of the things we're going to talk about at Q Denver is what is it that we can learn from those who've come before us that live in a time where, you know, in our book, 60% of Americans use the word persecuted to describe the Christian church. David and I are very careful to say, no, we don't think that's the best use of that word when our brothers and sisters around the world are giving their lives many times for the faith. But we do think there's pressure happening and that this pressure that we're feeling is a good thing. It's a good pressure. It purges out some toxins that maybe we've adopted into our life of faith and church that maybe needed to be purged. But it also forces us to ask some of these really big questions about how are we going to be a counterculture for the common good now that we live in a community that no longer necessarily respects or appreciates what it is that we believe. What does it still mean to practice faithfulness?
Good faith. That's what we want. And we can see it happen as we lead with love. We learn to love, we believe, and we live. A Good Faith is the book from Gabe Lyons and David Kinnaman. Gabe with us today, and he is the founder of Q, and you can find out about their great work at qideas.org, and they've got a big conference, their annual event coming up here in just a couple weeks in Denver, so you can find out more about that as well, qideas.org. Or check out the book, Good Faith, Being a Christian When Society Thinks You're Irrelevant and Extreme. It's new from Baker Books. And if you missed part of today's program or want to hear it again or pass it on to a friend, you know, we post all our interviews after the show. So if you go to the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com, you'll find the podcast archives there, and you can be encouraged by what you heard today and pass it on to a friend. And as always, we appreciate you listening to Connecting Faith.